Westwood One presents Two Chairs and a Microphone. In now, your host, Paul Mercurio.
Welcome to the podcast. This week, I am now still in Hollywood, California, and I am literally in Hollywood off of Melrose Avenue with the booker of the Hollywood Improv on Melrose, Jamie Flam. What's up, buddy?
I'm glad to be here in my own apartment.
In your own apartment that smells like incense because you had garbage, but it didn't smell that bad to me.
No, I walked in the house 5 minutes before you got here, and it was pretty rancid.
Is there a body in there?
A part of a body. But I got the forest blend incense just for that exact scenario.
You know, I was driving over here, and I'm like, I hope to God today I smell forest blend in some way, shape, or form.
Hell, it really worked out.
So, you were born and raised in Sherman Oaks.
Close. I was born, in L.A., and I grew up in the Valley.
Yeah. And I asked you at the beginning how to introduce you because, like, you are kind of like a renaissance man. I mean, you also have a podcast called The Long Shot, which I'm about to do with Sean Conroy and Amber Kenny, and that's on All Things Comedy Network, also on iTunes. And how musically inclined, yeah. Done stand-up, produced shows, produced variety shows, how did you end up booking the Improv, which is a huge club to book, and God knows it must be a colossal pain in the ass with all of us crazy comics. Yeah.
It was a long road. I started doing comedy in San Francisco in 2002.
Were you in school there?
No, I was after I graduated college. Yeah. And I just...
You were a religious studies major, too.
I was.
Yeah.
Randomly. You know, I had to pick a major, and it ended up being a great field of study. I love that stuff, and I'm still very much interested in, you know, spirituality and just religion in general. And
Eastern, you also, Eastern philosophies, right?
Yeah, certainly Buddhism, and, you know, that's where...
Do you study Buddhism?
That was my focus in my undergrad, yeah.
And do you practice it today?
It's funny, I mean, today I meditated for 10 minutes. It's been like a lifelong battle, almost, like, of trying to consistently meditate.
I want to do that, and I'm trying to figure out where can I learn? I don't have to spend $500.
No. I mean, there's obviously a million resources online, but I've read tons of books, and, you know, on an iPhone now, there's so many guided meditations.
Oh, really?
And that, for me, is an easy kind of
way. So you just use an app?
I use an app. Today, I listen to the sound of a brook, a stream of a babbling brook, I guess you would call it. And calmed my mind. I'm not good at it by any means, but
well, how do you know if you're good at it or not? Is it the ability to clear your mind?
Yeah, in theory, like I think it just takes years and years of practice. But you know, the more and more studies they do, like, they find that it's just, you know, because I deal with insomnia and stress and all these things, and it's supposed to be the kind of the cure all.
What keeps you up at night?
A million things.
Other than me calling, and when am I going to call?
Well, like, literally you calling at 3:30 a.m. asking for a spot. We're closed. I told you. I think the mind of an artist in general. Yeah. Someone that wants to create.
Yeah.
And, you know, certainly the stress of the improv. But, you know, when you want to be creating stuff and you're not constantly creating, and the stress that creates and ideas and...
Yeah.
Wanted to make everyone happy. I could go. The list goes on.
Yeah, like all of us. So when you're in college, are you thinking performing? Are you playing music? I know, and we'll talk about this. Like in eighth grade, you had a Beatle band.
Oh yeah,
like it. So music's kind of been in your bones since you were a kid, right?
Yeah, I always loved music and comedy. Mm-hmm. And when I got to college, I immediately got a radio show on KCSB, Santa Barbara's radio station. And it was a hip-hop. I was like obsessed with underground hip-hop in the 90s.
Really?
Which was, you know, at that point, now it's known as the golden age of hip-hop, where groups like A Tribe Called Quest and, The Far Side, and I can go on with that list. But so I had a radio show, I had a record label, and I was like, I'm going to be a music producer.
You had a record label? How did you get a record label? How does that
happen? Yeah, anyone can have a record label. But we actually printed up, you know, vinyl records and tried distributing them. And
you're discovering talent in the Santa Barbara area? Is that what you're doing?
No, I mean, that wasn't necessarily a hotbed for the hip-hop world, but...
that was more San Diego?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Beach Towns is where hip-hop really thrived.
Uh-huh.
Because of the sun. I'm just kidding. But No, certainly, you know, Los Angeles, and but there, I did work with a group of great hip hop artists in Santa Barbara. So when I graduated college, I was like, I'm going to be a record mogul, and that didn't pan out.
What was the hardest thing about trying to make that happen?
Well, it was, I mean, obviously it was the late 90s and, you know, 2000, 2001. It was like the industry was changing. It was probably the worst time to be getting into an industry that was dying. You know, this was, you know, iTunes was just starting to launch, but MP3 was still not like a household.
Was board. Napster around? Or
just... Yeah, that was like right around
so
Napster
that's
time.
That's the whole, yeah.
So, you know, like most people out of college, I was in San Francisco. I moved there because of the .com and I had a bunch of friends there, but 2000, the beginning of 2000, was still kind of the boom.
Yeah.
Where, you know, if you move to San Francisco, you're going to make, you know, $100,000 a year out of college. And I'm like one of the few people that found a job making close to $20,000. You know, like, I don't know how I paid rent and was just, you know, lost. Like a lot of people, like, what the fuck am I going to do?
Yeah.
And then, you know, went on a soul searching trip to Europe, 3 months backpacking. And it was while I was out there that I was like, comedy. I've always loved it. I used to perform it as a kid, and I was like, I'm going to come back and try to make a go of it.
Yeah, I saw that you, like, as a kid, tell people kind of the stuff you were doing and how old you were. I thought that was really interesting that as a kid. Yeah.
Well, as a kid, I got into this musical theater productions as a kid, and it was there that I discovered the Beatles and became obsessed with the Beatles. And in sixth, seventh, eighth grade, like every square inch of my room was Beatles memorabilia and posters.
And this is mid to late 70s?
I wish. No, I mean, I know I don't wish. No, mid to late 80s.
Okay, right. Okay. So that's a little...
I need to moisturize.
...rare to get into somebody that age group and generation to be into the Beatles like that is rare. Like, is it because your parents were, or just the music just resonated with you, or what?
Yeah, I think a bunch of things. I just looked up to a bunch of people that really loved the Beatles and were obsessed, and I just, you know, but then I became legitimately just, you know, there was a whole world around them. There's something enchanting and intriguing about them. Mm. You know, I remember walking to the Warehouse. I don't know if you remember the Warehouse. In L.A., it was like, you know, the CD store.
Okay.
And tapes. And right. I bought the Beatles 62 to 66 on cassette. And
cassettes. Nice. Yeah,
and fell in love. And then you start getting into the Beatles. And then you start, this whole world kind of develops where you're like, oh, shit. And then you discover Sgt. Pepper. And like, what the hell is this? And you kind of evolve as a fan with them as they evolve.
Yeah.
And I just became obsessed. Started a Beatles cover band called Revolution.
Yeah.
We took second place at Beatle Fest.
This is in eighth grade.
Yeah, it was eighth grade.
Wow. That's pretty ambitious for a 13, 14-ish year old kid to kind of start a band. You took second place?
Yeah, well, it's cool. I mean, Beatle Fest, I don't know if they still do it, but it's this huge festival, or was a huge festival, and I think they did it in different cities, but it was at the Westin Bonaventure downtown, like, you know, all the conference rooms, like, you know, you could buy Beatle memorabilia and... You know, like, I think I'm getting this right, like, Alf Bicknell, the Beatles limo driver from 64 to 66, is there signing autographs and, like, which is, like, the most obscure.
Well, everybody's, like, it's like that, those little baby sharks that swim around the big shark, right? Like, anybody's, you know, I once sold Ringo shoelaces.
Yeah, so that guy was there, signing. Too. But, yeah, they had a battle of the bands and, like, all these bands. Obviously, most of the people... And these bands were like, you know, in their 20s and 30s and 40s.
Right, right.
And then we get up there, you know, this band of eighth graders. And we had the singer. His name was Gabe Witcher. And he just had this commanding voice. And he was not, you know, taller than 5 feet at that point. And just belted out Oh Darling, which is not an easy song to sing.
And so is he closer to John or Paul?
Paul. Like, he just belted out Oh Darling. Wait, am I... No, it's definitely Paul. Mm-hmm. Oh, darling, your friend.
Yeah,
Paul.
Yeah, my close personal friend.
Who was at the fucking improv on Thursday night?
And you weren't there.
No, I was not there
because you decided to use your night off to actually have a life.
To watch Mad Men, I could have. We were just talking about that.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to laugh at you.
No, I didn't. You're here at my house. I live 3 blocks from the improv. Paul McCartney shows up, and
nobody calls you
at 2 a.m. I couldn't sleep, and I'm scrolling down Instagram, and I see 4 or 5 pictures of everyone and their mother with fucking Paul McCartney at the place I book, and no one thought to text me so I could walk over.
That's hilarious.
I'm not bitter.
No, not at all. And you put the knife down, will you? Come on, it's not that bad. Seriously. And are you thinking, well, maybe in eighth grade, oh, I'll front the band eventually, and like that'll be your thing?
Of course.
Yeah.
No, I mean, that was a great lesson too. I mean, I always had a musical ear, so I could, you know, if you gave me a song and said, learn how to do this, I could come back the next day and have learned and taught myself. But I didn't know how to read music. Soon after that Beatlefest performance, some older kids heard that me and my buddy Mike, who's also in the band, that we were, you know, getting pretty good. And they were forming a band. They were going to go in the studio, and they needed a bass player, which is what I played, and a guitar player. So they picked us up. And I'll never forget our first rehearsal. They're like, all right, we're just going to just jam. Let's go into an A and C and a D. It's probably not exactly what the chords were. But I didn't know what the fuck they were talking about. And I'm just trying to follow along, and it just was the most awkward thing. And I'm sweating because I can't keep up. And like, which one's an A? Dun, 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 dun. And I was quickly kicked out of that band.
Did they pretty much were able to out you that you couldn't read music and all that other stuff?
Yeah, I tried to play it cool. And I actually went and recorded in the studio with them, and it was the coolest thing ever. And then a week later, they called me up and said they wanted someone with more experience.
Oh, wow.
And it destroyed my soul because my buddy Mike remained in the band. And when you're in eighth grade and your best friend is still in the cool kid band, he was kicked out a couple weeks later, and I felt much better.
Yeah, but you set that up for him to be kicked out by planting bad stories about him.
Exactly. Well, you got to do what you got to do.
So why not sort of take lessons and learn all of the core things you need to? Why did you ever think about doing that?
Yeah, I mean, I took lessons, and just like I am now, like there was a laziness and not wanting to practice.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember going to my bass teacher once a week, and he's trying to teach me scales, and I'm just like, teach me how to play fucking
Led Zeppelin or whatever.
Some Zeppelin song or Cream. I remember him teaching me White Room. I don't know.
Did you shoot heroin to get completely into the experience?
Oh, of course. Yeah. No, I mean, my parents were the ones who suggested it and provided it. They're like, if you're going to do this, you got to do it right.
You got to do it right. Well, your dad, shoe repair guy, cobbler, was that his business, right?
Locksmith.
Locksmith, I'm sorry. And was he, and those two professions are so similar, that's why I always get them confused.
What did you say?
I don't know why I thought he was a cobbler.
Cobbler. No, they're kind of old world.
Yeah, exactly. I need shoes. I have a lock that needs to be picked. So did he or your mom, like, have any musical background at all?
No.
Wow.
They both, I mean, I grew up listening to a lot of oldies.
Yeah.
And they certainly exposed me to the Beatles. And
The
Beach Boys, I think, was my first tape. Like, the Beach Boys' Endless Summer.
It's funny. You can hear some of the influences of the Beach Boys on some Beatles songs. You know,
of course.
And the harmony and sort of. And Paul, I think, has talked about that in interviews. Like, that they thought that was a really cool sound.
Yeah, when their Pet Sounds album came out, I think, in 66. I think they've said, like, it was a huge inspiration for Sgt. Pepper.
Yeah.
And when they really started exploring with, you know, recording techniques and...
Well, you said something interesting from a fan perspective, because in talking to Paul, as I like to call him, I asked him, you know, were you ever worried about losing your fan base because you would change your sound drastically from one album to another? And he said, no, we just kind of... He calls it, we were four artists in flow, was the phrase he used, and that they were just, you know, doing their thing and... Whatever, they were just trying not to be bored, and figuring if we weren't going to bore ourselves, we wouldn't bore our fans. And so it was interesting as a fan that you embraced the radical change in their sound, as opposed to like, give me more of the same, right?
Yeah, no, and what's crazy is just thinking about, and obviously this has been talked about ad nauseum, but how compact their career was. Like, it really, you know, they came to America in 64. And we're done by 70. And, you know, the older I get, the more context and, like, the fact that over 6 years they evolved from, you know, Ed Sullivan to Let It Be and Abbey Road is, like, just incredible, the evolution in such a short time.
Yeah. I think that, you know, maybe it's part of that sort of when it's such a genius, the flame can only last so long as opposed to not so genius and a longer flame lasts. Like... you know, Huey Lewis in the News, you know?
You're a Louie or a Huey hater. I don't know. Sports, that's the only album reference I can really give you for Huey Lewis.
Exactly. So did you, so once you do the band or whatever, you're thinking, okay, I'm, but comedy isn't coming until you take this trip, right? And then you started doing comedy when you got back from this trip, when you were abroad, a trip abroad, right?
Yeah, well, comedy, I mean, I always loved comedy. I would write comedy and write sketches. And in high school, or in junior high especially, I had my dad's camcorder and I would make, you know, comedy videos with my friends.
Wow.
And so, but it's never occurred to me that that could be a career path.
Did you have influences in terms of that, like Monty Python or... you know, SCTV or...
Definitely SCTV. Saturday Night Live was like, you know, like my religion. Like every Saturday I would record it, watch it, and then the next, wake up early Sunday and then, you know, rewatch it, show it to my family, like, you know, rewind and fast forward, you know, Unfrozen Caveman Lawyer, and Phil Hartman was like my favorite, and yeah. Then, you know, Adam Sandler. And
how great were some of the SCTV sketches though, huh?
Oh, amazing. And that was like, for me, it was Nick at Night watching SCTV. And
yeah.
You know, and Weird Al Yankovic, which was a huge comedy inspiration for me, and a million other things. And I love sketch comedy. And but yeah, it never occurred to me that this could be what you do for a living.
Yeah.
And then I went to Europe. I was, you know, right out of college, had my bar mitzvah money. It was a Beatles themed bar mitzvah, by the way.
Yeah, tell people about that. It's a great story. You go ahead.
Well, I was, you know, seventh grade, obsessed with the Beatles. I was like, you know, and it's the valley kind of thing where just everyone has a big theme bar mitzvah.
Right.
And I chose the Beatles. Every table was a Beatles table, and got this Sgt. Pepper outfit that I took, you know, photos with so people could sign this giant blown up photo of me when they walked in. And where was I? Oh, yeah. Bar mitzvah.
Yeah.
But, you know, like in bar mitzvah, I think I made $3,000 or $4,000.
Nice.
And we put it in the bank. So after college, when I was trying to find myself, I was like, I'm going to do 3 months with a backpack in Europe. And while I was out there, a couple of things happened. One is there's a spot called Boom Chicago, which is
Is that in Amsterdam?
Yes.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
And it's great. And a lot of people from SNL have come from there. And I went to a couple of shows there when I was there and was just blown away. And
what blew you away about it? What was the... Because, I mean, at this point, you've kind of been seeing a lot of sketch comedy, so...
This was improv, and I don't know if there was any long form, but I was just blown away, and I think... Well, Jordan Peele from Key and Peele was one of the guys that was in the cast.
Oh, came out of there, right.
And another thing that happened is that right before I went to Europe, I discovered Mr. Show on HBO.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, binge-watched that, and I was... when I saw Mr. Show, I was like, that's what I want to do.
Yeah.
I want to make that. Whatever, the fact that existed.
Yeah.
I was like, I want to do that.
Yeah.
And then also...
I did shows with those guys at festivals when they were Mr. Show. Yeah. And they had one where they came out naked. It was just so funny.
I've seen the tape of that. It's really funny. And then while I was out in Europe, a friend of mine, he went to high school with a lot of my best friends from college, was cast on SNL.
Who?
His name is Jeff Richards. He was only on for a season or two, but he was, you know, just a couple years older than me.
From the Valley?
He grew up in the Bay Area.
Oh, actually. Okay.
And just, you know, without disparaging him in any way, it sounds disparaging, but I was like, fuck, if Jeff can get on SNL, Jeff, who I know, who I've hung out with, can get on, it just made it more immediate and more tangible. So I came back, I was like, I'm going to make a career out of this.
It's funny. It's not demeaning at all, because I interviewed somebody one time for the show, and he said he saw somebody's special and thought it was okay, but nothing that I couldn't do. And that was his impetus to get into stand-up. You know, I think that's a lot of, for a fair number of people, it's like, well, if he can do it, I can do it. You know.
Well, there's got to be a certain cockiness and, you know, confidence.
But yeah.
Yeah. When you see something, you're like, God, this person's making a career and, you know, connecting with people on this. Well, shit, I can do that too.
What about Steve Martin? Was that somebody that you connected with? Like, because it sounds like you would, given that you liked the SCTVs and you liked improv and you liked sort of the...
Oh, I mean, the Three Amigos was like, and that's something, another thing I credit, like, with choosing comedy, was my parents just exposed me to cool stuff. I remember on Christmas Day, like whenever that came out, say 83, 84, 85, whatever it was, maybe 86 or 87.
Mm-hmm.
It was somewhere in the 80s.
90, 2002.
Yeah, I think it was 2005. but that was, The Three Amigos was like my favorite movie.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, inane, silly comedy.
Was it stuff that sort of almost, well, was, I was going to say, but it wouldn't, that mocks the form, but I don't think you're really into that because you obviously book a major comedy club, so you obviously love stand-up as pure stand-up too, right?
I always loved stand-up. I kind of got away from it a little bit. When I was doing stand-up, it was a lot of it was more anti-comedy. And
so what were you doing? What were some of the bits or some of the...
I mean, like everyone concept. Else didn't like...
This is in San Francisco.
Yeah.
So were you performing like the Punchline or smaller rooms?
No. I never was a club guy.
Yeah.
And I was never even close to getting to that point.
Mm-hmm.
No, it was like open mics and small shows and
just
going up and doing characters. And when I was in San Francisco, I would just put on shows and they were very inspired by Mr. Show, but I would rent an art gallery and, you know, get my friend's band to play. And then we'd make a bunch of videos.
Mm-hmm.
And this is before YouTube, where there was like the fact that we, you know, had the wherewithal to just go out there and with cameras and I got Final Cut Pro and learned how to edit and would make these stupid videos and show the videos and do some sketches to lead in and out.
So what were some of the videos, some of the bits, sketches
that you... I don't know if most of them aren't funny at all anymore to me, let alone describing them. We had a puppet judge named Judge Jojo, you actually see up there, he was sassy and that sounds like the worst thing
ever. Was he a courtroom judge?
He was a courtroom judge.
Let me tell you something. You were way ahead of your time. I know a producer who is a major showrunner for a major show who has a concept for a show that he's developing and pitching called Judge Puppet. And basically it's a puppet judge. Real people come before him.
You need to connect me to this person because we're developing it too.
And the idea is to have like a celebrity name person voice the puppet. And are you really?
No, truly. Like me and my buddies that we developed this, we shot it in Eugene, Oregon in 2002. And we just started getting together again to take ideas. And like, we've always hung on to Judge Jojo. And like, we got to, you know, develop this for TV.
That's really funny. He's doing the same thing. I'll connect you with him.
It's weird that the ether of the universe is creating puppet judges.
There's a reason that we all come together, right?
Yeah.
It's like I'm supposed to put you connected with him and you have a huge judge. It's a pretty funny and makes like it's a show that makes sense when you hear it, right? Judge shows are huge, you know. Puppet and sort of edgy puppet stuff's always funny and sort of what kind of comedy are you doing in these art, for example, the art gallery that you're into? Like what are you doing musical stuff? Are you doing you're mocking the form? Like what is your stuff?
It was mostly sketch.
Yeah.
Sketch and the video stuff is what we're doing.
Any sketch where you're naked, I hope?
No. I won't take my shirt off at the beach.
Yeah, I wouldn't either.
For self-conscious, let alone on stage.
So you're getting good response from that, I would guess, if you're doing it and you're enjoying it, right?
Yeah, we pack it out and it was like, it's very San Francisco and these different art galleries and it was really the variety of it. And we'd get, you know, all sorts of music acts and to the point that my last show before I left in 2005 was, you know, we had hip hop artists and a couple of bands and then this huge venue called the Rickshaw Stop in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I'd get like 20, you know, painters and artists to hang up their stuff on the walls.
Cool.
So even at that stage, like I wanted to create an experience.
Yeah.
Not just a show where you come in and leave, but, you know, this is a night. This is, we're going to go out. It's going to be multimedia.
Yeah. And did that tell you... the stand once you left in 2005 you came to LA to LA and with the idea I'm going to keep doing stand-up or I'm going to keep doing these kinds of shows, these sort of variety shows, was that the plan for you?
You know, it's weird, I don't remember the exact plan other than I love doing this comedy stuff and I want to make a career of it. So I came back and started doing shows in town, like more alternative shows and doing my characters and showing my videos at shows and got into that scene. But it only took about 3 months before this opportunity presented itself where there was a brand new comedy theater opening up in Santa Monica and they needed a general manager.
West Side Comedy Theater.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I walked into this empty space this day in December. It was pouring rain and I had no experience. You know, I had experience putting on shows, but running a venue, I didn't know.
Yeah.
But the owner, you know, after a couple of weeks of interviews, he was like, this is advice I give to a lot of people. I wrote him this email. He was like, I like you a lot. I like your energy and I think you could be great, but you have no experience. And I've talked to a ton of other people that have experience running theaters. And I ended up sending this email like saying, look, I know I don't have the experience. I will work for free for the first 6 months.
Wow.
Thank God he didn't take me up on that.
Oh, but, he didn't?
No.
Because that's called prostituting yourself.
That, I guess it is. But he ultimately, he hired me on.
Yeah.
And I learned, you know, from just organically how to build a small theater.
And how, I mean, what were some of the big things that you learned in doing that? And, and when you say build, I would imagine to build a customer base that keeps coming back, mm-hmm. right?
I mean, literally everything. When I got there, it was an empty space. And then, you know, a stage was built. And then we got chairs. And then it started with, you know, Friday and Saturday nights. We would have, it was just improv shows. We'd have like, you know, four improv teams come, take the slots. I mean, literally the first night, I learned as I went. Like the first night, we opened the doors and I was the only employee. And jeez. I remember I was like taking tickets from people.
So you're literally like taking, and then...
And then I would run up to the tech booth and then I would run on stage and I'm like, welcome to the West. It was called the West Side Eclectic when it first opened. Welcome to the show. Here's your first group. Knife Fight, which is the name, actually was one of the names of the group. And then I would run to the tech booth and like play some music and then bring them on stage.
Right.
And then there's some people in the lobby still needing tickets and run over there.
And did you have the bar then like you have now?
No, there was no bar in the space yet.
Oh, thank God. You would have been like...
And
making the worst drinks ever.
Yeah, but it was like just learning as we went. And then, you know, the next week we had two new employees and then we had built an intern program and then slowly built out the roster of talent and all the shows that we had. And then we built a school.
So how do you do that? Like my mother has a furniture store in Rhode Island and she always says, I can't just sell the furniture. I'd be out of business. You have to sell stuff you don't like, right, as well. Like I noticed you have a Queen Anne chair and I'm like, oh. It's from your parents, I assume, or I don't know what.
I don't know how everybody got that.
It's like a cool old chair. It's like, anyway, so how do you, though, in a big city? So my mother kind of over time started to know like what her customers like and don't like. It's Rhode Island, she's in Providence, Rhode Island. It's fairly small. She has returning customers. But in a city like Los Angeles, how do you start to kind of give a theater its own persona and character, given that there's such an eclectic group of people in a city this big?
That's a great question. I mean, the improv is more of an example of that. Like the art of curation is the lost art, I think, for a lot of places. LA is different because there's so much talent where you can't have a niche. Like anywhere else you go, you kind of have to have more of a mainstream.
Right.
I mean, aside from obviously New York and Chicago and some bigger cities, but... I don't know. It's always been a challenge because I definitely have what I like and I have to compromise a lot of that at the improv because, there's 1,000 comics and all the politics and there's some nights where, like this past Saturday night would have been a good example of, or last week, of a night that had my stamp on it where I had Jackie Cation, one of my favorite comics, was headlining.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Maria Bamford and Roy Scoville and I guess you would, you know, say quote unquote a more alternative kind of show.
Mm-hmm.
And then at 10 o'clock, we had, you know, a live band on stage and, you know, Reggie Watts and, you know, just it's a little bit more eclectic. And I really like that. And yeah. When I first started booking the main room, I almost turned it down because I didn't really appreciate mainstream comedy.
Mm-hmm.
I was Mr. Show.
Mm. And what was it at the time about mainstream comedy that didn't connect for you?
A lot of it was just me being a little bit ignorant of to what it was. In my mind... you know, it had become, or a lot of what I saw was just like, you know, that kind of prototypical backward cap comic talking about bro-y's kind of stuff. And
yeah, men do this and women do that. And yeah.
And certainly there's that kind of element that's still not my favorite. Mm. But without having been exposed to the main room at the improv, there are hundreds of comics that I would have never appreciated or liked just because to me they were club comics. You know, there's always been that split, like with the club and the more alternative scene, at least in the last 15 years.
And I never understood, you know, comedy to me, the whole reason to do it, at least for me, is that there should be no rules and everybody should embrace everybody and everything. And a true artist doesn't compartmentalize, right? Like a great painter can go see a work, a gallery work of another painter and not go, well, he's a certain type of painter, so he's an impressionist and I don't look at it like... So I never understood that and never subscribed to it. And I like to work both rooms, you know, and I think you can.
Absolutely.
And not change who you are, right? like not really change your act. It's not like I got, okay, I got my alternative material, let me go to that book, and then I've got my club material, let me go to that book. And, you know, like I did Bar Lubitsch and I did the improv on the same night and did fine, you know.
Well, that's what makes you a good...
Well, comic. I don't know about that, but thank you. That's nice of you to say, but...
Well, there's no... I don't know if there's any great comics, by and large, that have not also been able to succeed at the club level. Mm. And a lot of comics from the other scenes don't realize that. Or I was one of those comics. I was like, fuck the clubs. I don't even need a club. Yeah. And now I have the utmost respect for it.
Yeah, and you look at like Louis. I mean, you know, look at Louis, the arc of Louis' stand-up, right? And, you know, now he's, you know, at the top of his game and, you know, the darling of especially the comedy community. He was, you know, he was a regular comic working out of Boston. When I say regular, I mean, you know, kind of just not bad, but whatever. And then kind of maybe got more, a little more alternative-y and sort of a more bizarre sort of concepts and stuff. And then moved away to, and I think back to being a more mainstream comic who's just talking about his life. Not, totally. And I don't mean just in a pejorative way, but just, you know, kind of not you, not sort of being super avant-garde. So, and I think that's a true artist as you go through these changes, right? Mm-hmm. All of them good and reflect growth. It's the guys that just keep doing the same thing that get stuck in the mud and, you know.
Well, there's, I mean, a lot of young comics that come out of the more alternative scene. And when I first started booking the main room, I was booking comics that I'd seen kill at alt rooms time and time again, people I look up to. And then I would see them fail at the improv. And, I, you know, there was really, a, the first year and a half was just me just learning.
And why would you, it's this is fascinating to me, and my listeners will really dig this. Why do you think they would fail in those big rooms? And vice versa, by the way. A club comic will go in an alternative room, it can fail there too. What's going on?
Well, a lot of times in the alt world, you know, there's a fan base that they're comedy nerds and they're comedy fans and they're obsessed with comedy versus a club where, and that's why Louis and a lot of those big names, and you too, you know, you have to fail at the Comedy Store and the improv to really know where your stuff is at, because that's, if it doesn't work at the improv, you know, it's not going to work on the Tonight Show.
Right.
You can get away with a lot more in an alt room because a lot of these people love comedy and you can make inside references and you can talk more about your personal life.
I also think you can, on a technical level, you can be more of a storyteller and sort of have longer setups and take longer to get to the punchline and not, and almost in a way, you know, maybe mask your punchlines a little bit, because in some alternative rooms they can be so judgmental that it's like, oh, are you really going for a joke here? Well, yeah, we are actually going for a joke, but the art of it is to make it look like you're not.
Right.
Whereas in a main club room, you got to kind of get,
and you have people that go to one comedy show a year, and you have a group of 20 people that are there for a birthday.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's not every night. We have nights where, you know, and a lot of, hopefully my legacy at the improv is I've tried to really bridge the gap with the independent scene a little bit more.
I think you have. Like people in LA, coming to LA, you should go to the improv because you're going to get a nice mix of, it's eclectic, it reflects you, you know, because you're going to see on a Thursday night, you're going to see an alternative-y kind of show. And then the night before that, maybe that night and the next night before, a more traditional show.
And well, I'm also trying to have more shows that have quote unquote alti people and in a good mix with great mainstream comics and bringing people together that you wouldn't normally have ever seen in a lineup at a club. This Thursday is a good example. We have two shows. Our 8 o'clock show is called Comedy Living Room. It's a show that literally was started in a living room, became one of the biggest shows in LA. And they would, you know, do a show in their living room.
Right.
And they would get huge names. And I met them at South by Southwest a couple years ago and was like, what does this show look like at the improv? And they started doing it monthly at the improv and, you know, literally putting couches on stage to kind of emulate the living room. And we'd get these great lineups, but we'd also get this young audience in that a lot of them had never been to a club before, because in their mind it was like, shit, it's going to be $25 ticket and there's going to be two at a minimum and there's going to be, you know, door guys yelling at me. And
yeah.
But what I've really tried to do is now they can come and like, let's do a $5 ticket on Thursday. And if you love seeing your favorite comics in a living room, imagine seeing it in a place that's designed acoustically and comfortable, and you can have drinks.
Yeah.
And then Chris Rock is going to pop in.
Is he really?
Or, I mean...
He could, yeah, yeah.
And then the second show was a show that started at a fish taco stand in Los Feliz. Los Feliz? Mm. Los Feliz? I never...
Yeah.
Same deal. It's like, what does that show look like at the Improv? And so now we're getting these young people back to the club. Mm. And they're seeing it doesn't have to cost an arm and a leg. And they still are supporting, and I still always support what's happening in LA. There's so many eclectic shows that
cool. Now, are these people coming to these two shows you just talked about, are they what you would call kind of more alternative kind of audiences, or are they open to mainstream, more mainstream type acts as well?
I think they're starting to open up more. In the same way that my first year booking the main room, you start to see, and going back to your question, like, a lot of times, you know, the altier rooms, they're a little bit savvier, so they can read through, and authenticity is of utmost importance, where, you know, if someone's doing their act and they can really read that this is an act, it could be, you know, a club comic that's been doing it for forever. Mm. If it seems a little bit forced or contrived, they don't like that. Mm. There's almost like that stand-up club comic cadence that they can kind of pick up on. They're like, this doesn't seem genuine.
Yeah.
So it's just, you know, being a little bit more real, I think, in those situations. And it's always a balance. You know, a good comic can read a room.
Yeah. And then do you, so like the living room show, is that, so there's like couches on stage and stuff like that. And then like someone brings out a comedian and they get interviewed? Like
No, it's a stand-up show.
Oh.
It's just a stand-up show with like this.
With a set of living room.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, I mean, the first couple of times we actually had people on the couches, like fans on stage, but of course every comic would like turn around and be like, this is really awkward.
Right, and then people are watching the people watching the comic and so.
But what I really love to do, and it's been going back to San Francisco, is like, I want it to be an experience. Mm-hmm. You know, like, when I produce a show.
Well, when you say experience, define that. Like, what kind of experience would you like people to walk away with?
Meaning, a typical comedy club experience might be, you know, you get in. Back in the day, like, I've had multiple comics be like, comedy clubs are where you go to get yelled at for whatever reason. Like, you have to buy two drinks, shut the fuck up, get in line over there.
Right.
So those little things, like when I put on a show, like, sometimes I'll, you know, we'll get a food truck in the parking lot and we'll have like a puppeteer doing some sort of marionette thing, and there's some kind of thing being projected over here. We will have bands outside. So the moment you walk in, you're like, oh my God, this is a night.
This is not a typical comedy club experience. Yeah.
But just like, in any, like, I want people to, like, I don't know. Like, I equate it to like when you watch a movie, when I watch a Coen Brothers movie or Quentin Tarantino or any great movie.
Yeah, yeah.
There's that moment where like the opening credits come on where like, you're like, oh my God, something will happen with the fonts or the music or whatever it is. Like, oh my God, I'm in for a ride. And a live show shouldn't be any different.
Well, there's a lot. There's not, you know, you're rare in that, you know, and I work all over the country, and there's some people that just, it's a business, and they could just be just as happy selling kumquats, you know what I mean? And some guys don't even come out of their office to see any of the shows, you know, the owners, because they book it through the agents and whatever, and as long as the numbers are good, you know, and, you know, you could... your act could be taking a shit in a bowl and just watch the shit steam for 45 minutes, and if it sells tickets, they'll put it on. And it's like, that to me is not art. That's to me not the kind of passion, the kind of place you want to perform at. The audiences can be fine, but like, sometimes you just find like they don't look at it the way you look at it, like as an experience that people have. And I get that they got to run a business and they got a mortgage to pay and whatever, and they're trying to make a lot of money, but I think you can have both. I think you can make money
absolutely
and like satisfy people artistically, both the artist and the customers, you know?
Totally. And that's there. They're not mutually exclusive. And that's been part of my battle with the Improv. And they get it. And there's so many wonderful people.
Hmm. Have they loosened the reins a little
bit? Absolutely.
Initially, where they were like, why are you booking these kind of different kinds of shows?
At the end of the day, like any business, like you said, they just want to make money.
Yeah.
And, but having an experience and all that. And then like, that goes to the music that's playing in the bar when you walk in. And the lighting. I mean, and Todd Glass, who I'm sure you know well, is like, he taught me a lot. And when I started the Improv 4.5 years ago, there was the lab, which was the small black box annex.
Mm-hmm.
And that I was, before I booked the main room, I was there for a year and a half, two years. And so, but it was just like this dead room. It was Second City for like 10 years. And then there was like this kind of purgatory of a couple of years where it's like, you know, there'd be a couple shows a week and hit or miss.
Right.
But I got in there and transformed that room, and Todd really helped me. Like, he's like, I know you're not getting paid anything. I know, you know, everything you're up against, but let's fucking make this room the best.
And how did he help you? What was some of the things that he...
I mean, he literally, like, one day, he just, like, he brought in, like, a bunch of stuff to make the green room more comfortable.
Oh, yeah.
We got up on ladders and fixed the lights. He inspired me. I went to my parents' garage and got a bunch of lamps and artwork and, you know, commissioned a bunch of artists to put art on the walls and, like, really just made it into a home.
That's great.
And, you know, that place really started taking off after that point.
Yeah.
So I've taken that same kind of aesthetic and tried to implement it in the main room.
So just real quick, any... just funny anecdotes and sort of in booking that room, because you've got you're juggling so much. You've got comics that are regulars, and you got the big names that want to pop in and do a set. And like, how do you deal with all of that on any given night? Louis C.K. pops in, Dan Cook, Marlon Wayans, whatever it might be, Louis Black, I don't know. But like, any funny anecdotes and sort of dealing with some of that?
Funny anecdotes?
Pain in the ass anecdotes? Or just...
Yeah, this job is a balance. I mean, it's some days I pinch myself because, you know, I get to be like, you know, in the epicenter of everything happening in comedy and meeting all these great people. The Comedy Store, I sometimes wish I was booking that place, because you have three rooms, and on any given night, the booker gets to book 20 to 30 spots every single night.
Right.
And in a typical week for me, I get to book 5 to 10 spots if I'm lucky, because of the politics, because of the types of shows we have. Live podcasts are bigger than ever. You know, every Friday night now we have Kevin Smith doing his podcast, you know, which is a huge show for us, but that's just another slot of where there's no stand-ups to book.
Yeah.
Most of our headliners bring all their own support.
And then some of them are produced shows where they've already got their people
locked in. So the number of spots I have is so limited. And so, and then those spots I do get, you know, they get eaten up by, like, sometimes it's great. It's like, you know, this week we have Amy Schumer is going to be in town, and Damon Wayans is always looking for spots. And so, like, those spots that I have will go to big names that will be exciting, and I know they're going to deliver. But then the other spots, you know, like, you know, the politics. Like,
yeah.
People forget that there's 30 improvs. So I have to make the agents happy and the managers happy so that we can get their clients for 30 other clubs.
Right.
So when APA and CAA and William Morris...
You don't piss them off.
Yeah.
You're very calm. You must be taking a lot of medication.
No, I had a nervous breakdown last week. I'm not even kidding.
Did you really?
I did.
What made you... What was the thing that pushed you?
I've been doing it for 4 years.
Mm.
When I first started, they told me the shelf life for this position is 2 years. And
because it just burns people out.
Burns people out. And then, you know, it's also like a springboard job where, you know, I know everyone in the industry. And,
yeah. And you go be an agent yourself or
eventually,
you know, a scumbag comedy club owner.
Yeah. That's my... I want to move to fucking... I want to say Phoenix, but...
Iowa
and be a scumbag fucking comedy club owner. They got a really good alti scene out there.
Put on your overalls. It's the alternative show in Des Moines.
They actually do have a great festival that my friend started producing.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Cool.
Comedy is booming right now.
It's like
every city, every state has some cool stuff going on.
So what happened with the nervous breakdown?
I just, you know, like anything, you got to take care of yourself. And at the nature of this job, you know, I'm at a club sometimes 7 nights a week.
Yeah.
And I drink for free.
Yeah.
And so I go through my own roller coaster of drinking.
Yeah.
You know, I smoked cigarettes for a long time, but I quit like 4 years ago. But then in January, for some dumb reason, at 38, I was like, I'll start smoking again. And I started taking Adderall, which is because I have focus. Like, you know, focusing is tough.
Yeah.
And it was working great. Long story short, last week, like, I felt my body was just like being like, fuck you, Jamie. And by Thursday, I was like, I think I'm having a heart attack. And rushed to the emergency room because I was like, had all the symptoms of a heart attack.
Holy shit. Like chest pains and everything?
Chest pains, numbness, like sharp pains in my jaw, like.
Whoa.
And
if you die, can I have that chair? That's
yours.
That mahogany queen
anne
chair. You have nice furniture, but anyway, go ahead. I always look at furniture. It's like rubbing furniture. So what did it end up being?
Like it was a panic attack. And I've never had that. And they said a big part of it was the Adderall. But in general, I am a very Zen person, and a lot of people I've told this, and they're like, that just makes no sense because you always seem very calm.
Yeah. Your emails are nice. You're just not.
Well,
and I'll be honest with you. When someone's nice like that, I'm, at least for me, you almost don't want to ask too much because, like, I don't know. It's just because you're nice. Not that I ask if someone's more than an asshole, but you know what I mean? Like, it's almost like you always feel a little bit like you're imposing because, but that's, I understand, part of your job. But I, at least for me, like, you're so cool. Like, you just be like, he's just a cool guy. I don't have the heart to be another guy bugging him sometimes. You know what I mean?
One of the things I've learned, and it's not easy for me, is but like I'm a people pleaser, for better or worse, and in a position where, and I hate even saying it, but I just kind of accept it now. There is a gatekeeper aspect to what I do, which it's near impossible to do that. And this job has forced me to learn how to say no.
Yeah,
but I still, my instinct is like, and also as a former stand-up and someone that still aspires to perform. And
yeah.
I empathize.
Yeah.
With comics, which is not necessarily a good thing.
No.
You know, it doesn't serve me because, like,
no, it actually does. I'll tell you why. Because I have said, and other comics will tell you, the worst people to deal with are comics that stop being comics and own their own comedy clubs. They tend to be the biggest scumbags sometimes. They'll short you on money or they'll conveniently double book and not tell you. And they're like a brethren. They've been through the war with you. So they should sort of treat you almost a little better, or at least as good as a regular comedy club owner would. And a fair number of them don't. And I think it's just a little maybe jealousy, like that they didn't continue their, you know. So I encourage you to be empathetic. Not to the point where you get walked over, which I don't think you would. But, like, you know, it's, you know, there's some bad eggs out there, you know.
Oh, sure.
You know, so
no, I always, and I can't make everyone happy, and you know, I've learned how to delete emails, even though, like, it breaks my heart when I'm doing it,
but your mom's, deleting your mom's emails is a little much.
I would actually never delete my mom. She's actually the funniest person.
Is that right?
If I get my comedy from anywhere, it's my mom.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is she just super sarcastic?
Oh God, she's just she's got the mouth of a sailor, and
that's awesome.
She's actually trying to work on her rap career right now, and I'm not kidding at all.
Wow, a Jewish rapping mother.
Oh, she's the best. Yeah. But yeah, no, it does make my job a little bit tougher, and that's, you know, but I have to learn. I the first year, like, I wouldn't know how to say no to anyone. But I think it's a good lesson for comics to know. It's like, when you don't hear back, God knows I want to write back to everyone. But, you know, if I want to do my job effectively and actually create and make this club everything I want it to be, you don't have time to respond to, you know, hundreds. I get hundreds of emails every day.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And
which reminds me, I have sent you 12 just today, and you didn't respond to any of them.
No, I hit my wall today, but you're in town. Like, let's get you up. We're going to get you some spots.
No, don't worry. It's all good. So people can check out your podcast. When does that post? Once a week?
Mm-hmm.
When tell people about that? And so, what you do on the podcast real quick.
Well, you're going to be on it and you'll find out.
Yeah.
But The Long Shot's been around for 5 years, which is kind of, it's a...
Did you start it with Sean and Amber?
It started with me, Sean, Amber, and Eddie Pepitone.
Oh, yeah.
And it was the four of us, and we did about, I think, 7 seasons together.
Jesus.
And it was a random hodgepodge that just kind of randomly came together.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking with Eddie about doing a podcast. So we got ready to go, and then he's like, I want to bring my friend Sean on board. It's like, great. And then Sean was like, I want to bring this girl Amber on board. And so it ended up being the four of us, and we became this kind of dysfunctional family.
That's great.
And we're all different phases in our career. When we started, like, Amber was, you know, open micer, and it was before I was at the improv, and I was actually in my own rock bottom, didn't know what the fuck I was doing. Sean, you know, was in his 40s and was, you know, UCB, but still didn't know exactly where he was doing. He was teaching classes. And Eddie, you know, Eddie was Eddie.
Yeah.
That's all I got to say.
Yeah.
And it started tracking us all in our ups and downs. And
talking about all this stuff on the podcast, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it captured, you know, our lowest moments, for me especially. Like, when we started the podcast, I just moved in with my grandma. I'd gotten out of a 7-year relationship. And I loved my time with my grandma, by the way. But, you know, I was 33.
And she raps. No, I'm just kidding.
No, she doesn't. But not yet. But I was 33, and it was just like this, like, fuck, I don't know what I'm doing. Why the fuck did I choose comedy as my career?
Mm.
My job at the West Side had ended, and My relationship is over. And so here I am now on this podcast with Sean and Eddie, who I really looked up to.
And are you performing at all or producing any shows at that point? You're just
still a little bit. I was doing a little bit of stand-up then.
Right.
But Sean didn't know me, and he would give me shit. And I got through that, you know, to the point where, oh, shit, now I got this job at the Improv. And people started seeing this evolution.
Yeah.
And really were able to connect with all of us. And now, you know, Sean is the head writer and producer on a series on Adult Swim, and Amber, his career is taking off and she's doing stuff. And Eddie, you know, quit the show because, you know, like his documentary came out and he started touring the country. And
yeah.
So it's a funny podcast. It's a comedy podcast, but it's more about, we're talking about the terrors of everyday life.
Yeah.
And
what you're going through.
The struggle and of making it as an artist and trying to.
And you're all willing to kind of expose yourself in that. Yeah. That's great. It's called The Long Shot. It's on All Things Comedy. if you want to see some of the best shows booked in Los Angeles, go to the Hollywood Improv on Melrose. No, because you're a pure art. My wife's a curator. She's historic costumes and clothing and textiles and an archivist.
Awesome.
In museums. And so that word curate really struck a chord with me, you know, because I think you have to have people in all art forms that just, you know, she could have done fashion and just made money in the fashion world. She's more into curating and sort of educating people about the history of, you know, decorative arts and that kind of thing. And you need both people, you know. So I, you know, it's rare to have somebody running and booking a club that big and mainstream, but with an artist vibe and feel, and it's coming through in the club. So
awesome, thank
you. You're doing a great job, and this was very cool. This is Jamie Flam, and if you need, for any of your kids' parties, bar mitzvahs, if you need a Beatles cover band, Jamie's your man.
I got it. I'll you have to send me the songs beforehand so I can learn them.
All right, man, thanks a lot. Awesome.
Yeah, thank you.
And when you get a second, folks, head over to iTunes to give us a review of the podcast. Some nice positive feedback goes a long way.
A Westwood One podcast production.